Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 118 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week on our read-along, we will be discussing chapter 30, entitled Lollybrock. And this is the first chapter from part 5.
So first, a comment from Lisa T. She writes, in terms of the structure of the books, this chapter provides the happy ending in some ways to Outlander. You could almost add the first half of Dragonfly and Amber to Outlander, and this chapter would provide the happy ending. Over the last few chapters, we have come full circle with Claire sacrificing her virtue to save Jaime, and in this chapter, we see Jaime and Claire triumphantly returning as Laird and Lady of Lallybroch, with the promise of peace and happiness. Quote, let Charles make his own peace with exile then, I thought. Our own was over. We were going home. So the chapter begins with a little bit of background on Lallybroch. So the full name of Lallybroch is Broch Tuorach, and it means north-facing tower. Jaime tells Claire that it's, quote, north-facing because the door faces north.
Well, but she had a really good point when she stated, If it's a circular...
Cylindrical
feature, how do you decide what is facing north? Because there is no side, it's one continuous side. So it was a really good point that Claire made, which was, you know, quickly dashed by...
his smart aleckness.
Well, but it was true, though. If that's how you gauge it, because there's a door and it faces north.
Yes, but if you also listen to Davina's recording... His answer, his reply to her, at least the way she says it, it's like, there's a door, and it faces north. So there you go. It makes sense. That's it. Basta. You know what I mean? Like, there's
a
reason.
I'm pretty sure they didn't say that.
No, they didn't. But that's what I read into that. So the tower also leans a bit, hence lazy. Or lally, I presume, means lazy. The tower has also fallen down a number of times over the hundreds of years it's been there. They just put it back up. Ellen G. writes, quoting Jaime, it hasn't got a face, and the tower, the roundness of it, continues to go round and round and round like the seasons, the years always going another round, never stopping. On the way to Lallybroch now, Fergus is excited, yelling and kneeling on his saddle. Fergus loved being with or on horses ever since his adventures at the King's...
The Royal Stud,
thank you. Ever since his experience at the Royal Stud, he's been all about the horses. As Lallybroch came into view, Jaime's posture changed. Quote, I saw Jaime's head rise and fix as he saw the home farm of Lallybroch below. He stood quite still for a minute, not speaking, but I saw his shoulders lift and set themselves square. The wind caught his hair and the folds of his plaid and lifted them as though he might rise in the air, joyous as a kite. Ellen G. writes, Jaime and Claire were bringing good breeding horses to Lallybroch for future use, their minds on the future, and that future being in Lallybroch. This is a very different homecoming for Jaime than the previous one. This time it is light, not weighed down by guilt and fear.
Well, that, and there's not a price on his head. He thought that Jenny was carrying Randall's bastard, and it was all his fault, and he felt a lot of guilt associated with that. But I don't think his guilt had anything to do with the price on his head, is what I'm saying.
So en route to Scotland, this is going back a little bit in time, they sailed on one of Jared's ships, one called the Portia, to get to Scotland. We find out that Jared had named his ships for his mistresses. Apparently... He liked well-endowed women.
Well, this was all... She couldn't tell whether or not he was being honest or if this was just a rumor. So she didn't know if to take him seriously. But if he was to be taken seriously, he did have a fondness for large-busted ladies.
Claire will definitely... Or they, in general, I guess you could say, because she uses... Diana uses the word wheel, or through Claire's speech, or through her words. She uses the pronoun we, but it is Claire's thought or Claire's speech. She slash they will miss Jared, but also Louise, Mother Hildegard, Herr Gerstmann, and of course, Master Raymond. Thus far, it seemed that Charles Stuart wasn't continuing with his venture.
I do feel like that was really short-sighted.
Of them?
Of them.
To say, because, oh, so Charles didn't make it, so boom.
Well, it's not only that, but it's the assumption. So neither of them were there originally during the first... Okay, this is so weird. This is the
during
time
the
travel.
First time it happened?
This is the... I know.
That they
this
haven't
is,
gotten to yet?
I know. This is the...
Summer's big pause is because of TT.
Stop it. It was time travel. I'm not saying TT.
That's big TT.
Okay. Stop saying that. Big, little, it doesn't matter. Don't say TT. Okay.
It's going to happen.
Oh, it doesn't have to, though.
But it does.
Oh, okay. Anyway, because Claire was not there during the first time around, that led up to history, the history that she knew growing up, because she was growing up as... In her, I know, but in her lifetime.
In her timeline.
Thank you, timeline. In her timeline, she was not there. She didn't know the ins and outs of what led up to everything going down. So the assumption that everything that played out while they were in France was different than perhaps everything that played out originally is short-sighted.
I don't think it's necessarily short-sighted. I see what you're saying, though, because this is his life. This is her. I mean, she's alive. It's her life, but she's out of her timeline.
Is she, though? I would contend and put forward for people to think about that she always went back.
I don't disagree. And that's an entirely different conversation.
I know, but if she did, then everything that played out was exactly the way it happened the first time.
That's a completely other conversation that we can have, and I find very interesting. I do want to talk about that, but that's not what you started with. So you started with...
That's where I was going, though.
You started with, I find it very short-sighted of them because neither of them had been through this, and they knew that it was a chance they were taking that they may not affect anything, they may be able to change it, but they knew they wanted to try. It was worth a try. They knew going into this that... Short of like murdering Charles Stuart, and then who knows what else could happen on the side. But they knew going into this that it was just their best shot. And they were willing to try it. But also, because they hadn't, this is the first, what is to come, Culloden, is the first historical happening that Claire knows is coming so closely that she knows something about. And so because she slash they haven't been through something yet of major historical significance, yes, it's a big question. Can we affect it? Can we change it? We don't know. Not just do we not know because we haven't tried or been through this, we haven't been through a thing of historical significance yet. And this is played up much more in later books, right, without going too far into that. But she doesn't know how Diana's time travel works. Of course, she's a character in a book. She doesn't know about Diana. But she doesn't know this. And the reader doesn't know this. The reader is there like Claire. I wonder if they can change. I wonder if, you know, can you affect big things? Can you affect little things? Can you affect timelines?
Agreed. But how would you ever know?
You don't know.
That's my point. So even if you, while you're in it and there, there's, unless you had a history book with you that
two
constantly...
history books.
That constantly changed as you did things, like that you could literally, like, mark it.
Like see it
this
change.
Used to say X, Y, Z, and now it says A, B, C. Unless you had that, there's literally no way that you could accurately state that
I made a difference. Exactly. And because they don't know how they may have made a difference or not, I can see both sides. One, maybe it was short-sighted of them to assume that the little thing or the big thing, whatever it was, that they helped affect that Charles Stuart was unsuccessful in his shenanigans. Or, I mean...
I like that we're just, like, taking that all the way down. They were just shenanigans.
Well, actually, his shenanigans were actually successful because Louise got pregnant. But his hopes of a Scottish throne, shenanigans. So we have shenanigans with the big S, shenanigans with the small S. Okay, there's our title. There's our title, shenanigans. Actually, we come back to what something you've said before. Although maybe that was on the other podcast. But Schrodinger's cat. It is at the same time
I thought you said shorting your cat, and I was like, shorting my cat? What? And
then that was when you chopped her tail off.
That was your cat.
But you chopped her tail off.
I did not. She ran through the door at a really bad moment.
That you had the door for.
It was a heavy door.
But
I didn't physically close it. It had an automatic swinging door.
But anyway, it's just funny that Summer mentioned shorting my cat when she actually did that once.
I didn't say shorting your cat. I said shorting the cat, didn't I?
I think you said your. I brought it back home because you actually shorted my cat.
Okay.
Like 20 years ago. So it is a little bit like Schrodinger's cat. It is a little bit short-sighted, but it's also not. It's short-sighted. If they assumed, which they don't really know either way, like you said, if they assumed that what they did was enough to affect or change or stop Culloden, that's one side of the cat. The other side, or the alive cat or the dead cat, I don't know which one. The other one...
It's both. That's the whole nature of Schrodinger's cat.
The other is that they aren't short-sighted. So you could say both at the same time. So it will be interesting to look at it from that angle, how much they did or were able to do, and see what comes of that, of what they did to stop Charles in their time in France.
Whenever I think time travel, I always go back to Back to the Future. And it was really helpful for Marty McFly to have that photograph
where everyone
was continually like disappearing. So you knew he knew he fixed it when everyone was back in the photograph. Claire totally needs her own photograph.
Equivalent of a photograph.
Yes. She needs her thing. Like I said, it would be really cool to have a history book that continually changed every time they fixed it.
Agreed.
But they don't have that. However, in Back to the Future, Marty McFly had his photograph of his family that kept becoming smaller and smaller and not existing as he was effing things up in the past. So, just saying. She needs her own photograph.
Oh my gosh.
And a hoverboard. We all need hoverboards.
No, the photograph's enough.
Could you imagine, though, what they could have done with Culloden with a hoverboard? There's got to be something cool they could have done.
Jamie, ever the one to be seasick, had decided to drink himself into oblivion rather than take Claire's proffered laudanum.
Can you blame him, though?
I've never taken laudanum. I'd just rather have laudanum. If I were that sick, I'd just say, give me a pill or give me a whatever. I don't want to get nasty drunk. Then I'll be barfing. No. Just put me out.
See, and I don't know. How long is a channel crossing? And in that time of...
It seemed not too long, huh?
Yeah. I mean, in that era, I don't know how long a channel crossing would be. And if it was only going to be basically overnight, eh.
Take the laudanum.
No, get drunk. Who cares? It's all going to feel the same. He's going to feel like crap.
That's true.
And he said, if I'm going to feel like crap no matter what, I'd rather enjoy getting to the point of feeling like crap.
Getting there. Myrta says about Jamie, he said if he was going to have a headache, he'd as soon enjoy the getting of it. So they sail, and Jamie's head is in Claire's lap during the journey. She tells him he's going to feel like hell in the morning. And he replies, quote, between hell now and hell later, I will take later every time.
Clearly. I mean, that makes sense.
Back on the way to Lallybroch. Claire's horse refuses to continue
back on the way to Lallybroch. Isn't the whole thing on the way to Lallybroch? Even if they were on the boat, technically they're on the way to Lallybroch.
Claire's horse refuses to continue on their path. Something scared it. We don't find out right away. And nothing Jamie did would sway her. So they end up being taken a different direction. LNG writes, along with Jamie and Claire are Myrta and Fergus. It's interesting that Claire's horse is bothered by something unseen to humans. And this is getting a tiny bit ahead of us, but we're going there in just a minute. Ellen continues, was it the ghost of McNabb? Even with the Jamie magic with horses, the mare wouldn't go on the road. And so they all went into the field and crossed it to get to Lallybroch.
Well, let's be honest, though. I don't care how hot the guy is. If it's my death phobia, I'm not doing it. For real. Don't look at me like that.
I haven't looked at you yet. I'm looking at the monitor.
No, you're purposely not looking at me, which is the same as looking at me like that.
So the first possibility that we see that may have been scaring the horse turn out to be Ian and a dog.
Turned out?
Excuse me?
You said turn out.
The first possibility turns out.
You said turn out.
I did say turnout.
Turnout for what? No, it was like so ghetto. Turnout to be. This all has to come out, but I'm just saying you said it wrong.
Maybe it doesn't have to come out. The first possibility of what may have scared the mare
better
turns out to be Ian and at least one of the dogs. we find out that, at least as far as their being their expected arrival, they're about a day early at least.
Because they had good wind.
Jenny's mad with cleaning and cooking, and we find out she is pregnant again. And little Maggie is less than a year, so due in February, Ian says. And he implies
Jenny's the wanton. It's all her fault. He wasn't involved.
Ian implies that it's Jenny. I didn't do it again.
No, you didn't.
Stop it.
It's still in my head.
You mean your ear?
All of it.
Ian implies that it's Jenny who needs restraint, not him. He says they've lost 15 ewes and a ram, and this is Jenny's flock of merinos that she keeps for their special wool.
But his restraint had nothing to do with the wool and or sheep.
No, it had to do with her getting knocked up again.
Okay, because that sounded like it was one statement, and I just wanted to make sure.
I'm just trying to get through it so I don't have laughter again.
Okay.
So regarding looking for those sheep, Ian says that they won't go so far. They won't go past this cottage,
Or at least not in that direction.
Yeah, and Fergus says, you know, I didn't see anything, any cottage. I just saw piles of stones. And he is, of course, speaking, we learn, of the ruins of the McNabb cottage. Ronald McNabb was the one who had betrayed Jamie to the watch about a year earlier.
Nobody likes him.
Susan M. writes, as Jamie meets Ian and discovers the remains of McNabb's cabin, the way Ian describes how the house must have caught fire and burned down, both times I listened to the chapter, suggested to me that Ian was sort of implying that he had something to do with it. After the first time I listened, I went through it again, and I definitely got the same impression again the second time. But wasn't Ian injured when Jamie was taken by the watch in the book Outlander?
Yes.
I didn't think he would be physically able to go set the McNabb's house on fire, but it did seem to me like maybe he was suggesting he did. I think it was more of like an en masse tenants thing.
My impression of that whole goings-on was that everyone
took part.
Like, and I'm not saying they all did, but everyone kind of
agreed.
Was accepting of it. They were like, "This is what happens."
Like, homie, don't play that. Yeah,
right. You don't do that. Mm-mm. He's been taking care of you. He's been taking care of the land. You're clearly an alcoholic and a jerk. You deserve this. Nobody was upset when he passed is where I'm going with. So even if they didn't have a part in it, they wish they had, to a degree.
McNabb had died for the same reason, giving up Jamie, within a day. His family, though, had survived. Only his widow, Mary, would go up to the ruins. So Jamie goes up to the stones, and Claire follows him. Jamie walks around the clearing, circled the hearthstone three times, always counterclockwise, to, quote, confound any evil that might follow. He said a prayer, it seemed, and then picked up a stone, put it onto the pile, and crossed himself, and met Claire, saying, don't look back. And she didn't.
Because that's the creepiest thing you could ever say to anyone in any kind of a horror movie.
I just got a flash. Okay, from two things. There's a Greek myth of, is it Persephone as she's leaving the underworld? Oh, no, sorry. Her lover.
No, Persephone's was that do not eat anything while you're there. If you do, you'll have to stay here. So.
Yeah, but I think it was her lover. Anyway, there was a dude in Greek mythology whose lover, or whatever, was in the underworld. And I thought it was Persephone, but maybe not. He wants his love back. And he's told by someone, maybe by Hades, I don't know, that, okay, you can have her back, but until you get to a certain distance or whatever, you can't turn around. Or I think it was
definitely not Persephone, because Persephone
in the underworld.
Persephone spent half the year with Hades because he was in love with her, and then half of the year.
Okay, so as this wife, lover, whatever of this person was leaving, the guy didn't listen, and he turned and looked, and she turned into a tree, I believe.
I'm gonna take your word for that.
I think that was one, and that was the first thought.
Job. Was it Job? Yep. Pillar of salt.
Yeah.
Okay,
but that's different. I mean, it's two stories. They're different. I'm just saying it's one's Greek mythology, one's Jewish, Judeo-Christian mythology. Yeah, so, and that was...
No, it was Lot's wife.
Okay.
I said Job originally, but it was not Job.
Was
I
Lot.
Think you're right, it was
it
Lot.
It was Sodom and Gomorrah.
It was Lot's wife, I believe. Yeah. It turned into a pillar of salt, and I'll look that up right now just to make sure.
So, yeah, so we have those two. We have a Jewish mythology history connection. We have a Greek mythology connection that I just thought of. And then the funny thing is, I didn't say anything before, because it's not mythology necessarily, but the name of the ship that they took to Scotland was named Portia. And Portia was a rich young woman in a Shakespeare play. And she had three, like, small caskets that her people who wanted to marry her had to choose the right casket. And if they chose correctly, then they would win the prize, which was her hand in marriage. But the ones, luckily the ones she didn't want, chose incorrectly. But I couldn't necessarily see a link between that name and that character and the ship. But
Genesis 19:26. But Lot's wife looked back and she became a pillar of salt.
Okay, so that is different then. So Lot's wife looked back and she became a pillar of salt.
Correct.
In the Greek myth, the guy looked back and the girl became a tree. So the girl who was being looked at
woman.
Turned into a tree.
Okay. It said they summoned Eurydice and gave her to him, but upon one condition, that he would not look back at her as she followed him until they had reached the upper world. So the two passed through the great doors of Hades to the path which would take them out of the darkness, climbing up and up. He knew that she must be just behind him, but he longed unutterably to give one glance to make sure. But now that they were almost there, the blackness turned to gray, and now he stepped out joyfully into the daylight. Then he turned to her, but it was too soon. She was still in the cavern. He saw her in the dim light, and he held out his arm to clasp her, but on the instant she was gone. She had slipped back into the darkness. All he heard was one faint word, farewell. She did not turn into a tree.
Okay.
But she did get sucked back into Hades.
So no tree.
No tree. There was a tree myth. I did find it, but it was not the same. It was Daphne and Apollo, but it was different.
Oh my gosh, my Greek mythology is so jumbled.
It's okay. Put all that in your show notes.
Cello writes, in this chapter, the ghost is that of Ronnie McNabb, who died for his part in betraying his lair to the Watch, causing Jamie's second removal from his home. An oathbreaker who died a violent death when the other tenants took vengeance for the betrayal of their laird, it's clear he doesn't rest easy. It seems Jamie has learned the lesson about not putting this sort of thing off. Instead of avoiding the issues as he did with his first set of ghosts, as soon as Jamie hears the tale of Ronnie's, quote, accidental demise, he goes straight to the ruined cottage and makes what peace he can with the restless and possibly vengeful spirit. Once again, Claire is witness to Jamie's efforts to forgive and be forgiven, and she knows well enough to stand aside and simply be his rock to stand firm upon instead of trying to mediate. It's a sign of how much they've grown despite their setbacks in their understanding of what the other needs. I find it interesting that the rock Jamie picks up and places on the pile is the size of his fist, approximately. It was Jamie using his fists to, quote, convince Ronnie to let Rabbi stay at Lallybroch as stable boy that led to Ronnie betraying Jamie to the Watch. Jamie had agonized over whether it was the right choice to use force to convince him. Maybe the rock was both apology to Ronnie as well as protection against the ghost. The line about not looking back is so very much an allegory for Jamie forgiving himself for his part in Ronnie's death, as well as to prevent inviting the spirit to follow them home. He literally lets go and puts the whole ugliness behind them, and Claire does too. Ellen G. writes, Jamie going to see the McNabb home. Very superstitious for an educated man. Except this time, Claire doesn't question it or him. Just accepts it as it is.
But that's an ongoing thing, though, isn't it?
That happened. Superstition?
Yeah, that happened.
His superstitiousness?
Yes, but he finds a way to exist on both of those planes, where he is a superstitious Scot, but he's also got some common sense and understands that there's a difference between the two, but he always gives
and
reverence.
And also devout.
But he always gives reverence to the others.
Lisa T. writes, "Just when it looks like a happily ever after, they come upon the ruins of the McNabb cottage. This is a reminder of Jamie being betrayed and the hideous events that followed. This closes a chapter in many ways and provides final resolution to many of the events in Outlander and the first part of Dragonfly and Amber." Susan M. writes, "Also, when Jamie places the stones on the cairn, quote, to keep the ghosts from escaping, or something like that, then he crossed himself, the combination almost seemed like he was forgiving McNabb. Jamie is such a Christian. I think this is just an early demonstration of how not only good a person Jamie is, but also a good leader. Almost like he wants the ghost to be held at bay to keep his tenants from being bothered by the ghost." And then we arrive at Lallybroch. Jamie, Fergus, Myrta, and Ian go to look for the sheep. Then they arrive at Lallybroch. Jamie, Fergus, Myrta, and Ian go look for the sheep. Claire goes to the house with the horses. Claire juxtaposes this homecoming with their first one. They had both been on the run. Now they are truly lord and lady of the manor, freely and legally. Her horse freaks out. Again. Jenny had been holding one of the feather mattresses that were being aired out. She dropped it, ran to Claire, and helped her with a horse. Rabbi McNabb and Mary joined Jenny. When they hug, Claire smells Jenny, quote, cinnamon and honey and the clean sweat of exertion with an undertone of baby scent, that paradoxical smell composed of spit up milk, soft feces, and the ultimate cleanliness of fresh, smooth skin.
Like, I don't disagree with
that. This is like the whole dog fart thing.
Thank you. I'm like...
You agree?
Because I'm like, baby poop would have been sufficient, but soft feces just took it that extra scientific level that made it just a little bit more gag-worthy.
Or more Gubbledonian.
Okay. Are those synonymous?
Not necessarily. Little Maggie is walking, we find out, and quote, the terror of the house. They all take care of the mattresses before the rain comes. Young Jamie, we learn, is almost 4. Claire tells Jenny that Fergus is Jamie's when Jenny asks about him. When the men finally appear after having retrieved the sheep, Ian hangs his plaid to dry. Fergus, quote, sat down where he was and stared numbly at the floor between his legs. She tells Jamie to piss on the doorposts if he's been to the high field. Jamie says, nah, thank you. Jenny, all soft and sweetness, says, Jamie, my dearie, do you want your dinner or shall I feed it to the dogs? Cello writes, and how much do I love Jenny, who is probably one of the only people, aside from maybe Claire, who can out-stubborn Jamie. She's a master of finding the right lever to move that rock. Oh, I do hope we hear Laura Donnelly say that.
I mean, it's right in line with how they've crafted that character for...
Oh my gosh.
For the actual series.
I mean, okay, to go to the series. I love Jamie, I love Claire. I mean, whoa, I'm humming for BJR, well, for, yeah. But I think the most pleasant surprise as far as, like, adaptation of character, like, straight out of your, like, out of my mind, out of my dream of whoever Jenny could be. Oh my gosh, Laura Donnelly. Hits it out of the park.
Oh gosh,
she is so... I mean, Katrina is Claire. She is. Sam is Jamie. Tobias is Frank. And BGR. Everybody does such a good job. But with Jenny, oh my... I mean, I guess that's just more wording for the talent of this cast. Because you can say that for, like, everybody. But she, like, balls to the wall, knocked it out of the park. I mean, it is so Jenny. So guess who wins? Jamie takes Ian, Myrta, and Fergus with him, then says as he's leaving, welcome home, with a last wistful glance at the fire and the whiskey. Ellen G. writes, why didn't Jenny yell at her own husband? Why pick on her younger brother, Lord Broch Tuorach? Because she could, I suspect. Cello writes, there are so many parallels between the chapter in this book and the chapter by the same title in Outlander. I am struck by the similarities between these two homecomings. In both cases, coming home to Lallybroch means confronting and laying to rest ghosts from Jamie's past, particularly in relation to the events leading to his forcible removal. In the first book, the ghost was Jamie's guilt over the part he played in his sister's rape, his father's death, and his failure to see his father to rest. Kim H. writes, I mainly got an overall feeling of Jamie and Claire going home to heal, find security and stability in a simpler life than the one they had just said goodbye to. To now look forward to new possibilities. Saying goodbye to a few friends in France was just a small sacrifice for peace and really renewing their love for each other. And Lisa T. writes, it's not a perfect happy ending after all. At the end, we see that Claire and Jenny are snug in the house while Jamie and the men are forced back into the miserable night. The chapter doesn't end with a perfect easy homecoming where Jamie and Claire are going to live happily ever after as Laird and Lady of Lallybroch. It ends with them apart, if only temporarily, foreshadowing things to come.
And that was chapter 30. Please join us for our next read-along when we will be discussing chapter 31, entitled Mail Call. And that's M-A-I-L and not M-A-L-E. Both of which would be very interesting chapters, but very different.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, Audioboom.com. Our Audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/OutlanderPod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at OutlanderPod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/OutlanderPod or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.